Welcome to the Language Mastery Show. This is your host, John Fotheringham. In today's episode, I chat with Idausa Ness, who's an accomplished polyglot, a world traveler, a musician, and the founder of the Mimic Method, which helps language learners adopt more native-like pronunciation through the power of phonetics and mimicry. For show notes, go to languagemastery.com/show. All right, without further ado, enjoy my chat with Idausa.
The first thing I usually like to get into is, if this were a comic book version of your life, what would be your origin story? Like, how did you get into languages, or is that something that's always been part of your life? You know, some people, they have kind of an aha moment, or other people, they struggle with languages in school, then finally had a breakthrough that changed everything. So walk us through that story.
Yeah, for sure. So I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania suburb, and the defining mood of my childhood for much of it was boredom. I lasted friends, a good, you know, good family and stuff like that. But yeah. I really wanted to get out and explore. So I had figured out a way at my senior year of high school to graduate a semester early. I figured out I had done enough coursework to do that. Wow. And I somehow kind of managed a way to flee to Mexico for my last semester of high school.
Wow.
Yeah. And I stayed with a homestay family, and my intention was to learn Spanish. I didn't particularly struggle in Spanish in school. Wasn't particularly good at it either, but you know, just high school Spanish, no one really learns anything there. So when I got to Mexico, I was excited at first, my first time living abroad on my own, being like on my own in a place. But very quickly, like, started to suffer from the deepest loneliness I had experienced up until that point in my life. I guess I was 17 then or 18.
Yeah.
And the reason was because I wasn't able to communicate with anybody. So I had no idea what Mexicans were saying to me when they were speaking Spanish in their natural way.
Right.
I would get tongue-tied and stutter all the time when I speak. I was going to classes, doing, you know, normal coursework, learning the grammar, all that kind of stuff. I didn't really have any trouble with that, reading and writing. But when it came to conversation, it was an eternal struggle. And which is fine when you're in high school, like whatever, just one period of a day. But when you're immersed in the entire place, I had like homestay brothers, and you know, it's just like I was just in this, you know, surrounded by people, but in complete isolation.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's kind of where I was at. And then I don't really remember what inspired me or what kind of clued me into this, but I kind of made a decision. I was like, you know what? Like, obviously, I'm going to be sucking at the Spanish thing for a while, but while I suck at it, I might as well make it sound good, right?
Mm.
And I said, you know what? So instead of going to a restaurant and being like, puedo tener más guacamoles con mis tacos, you know, the way I would normally say it with my American voice,
yeah.
I was, you know what? How would Antonio Banderas say this? You know, like,
yeah.
Well, it's like a super Spanish way. And then I'd practice him really going in on not just, you know, every single element of how Mexicans spoke. And when I started to switch my focus on the sound, each time I would make an attempt, have fun with it, I'd be like, no, that's not quite it. What's going on here? Like, oh, his voice goes up at the end, or like, mm-hmm. Oh, what's she doing with her mouth here? Like, her tongue's kind of placed here. And just started paying more and more attention to the way Mexicans sounded while not really worrying about what the things meant. And after like a short period of time in doing this, maybe like a week or two, all of a sudden I started to experience breakthroughs. And, I remember actually the first time in my life very vividly that I ever understood another human being and what they were saying to me fully in a foreign language. And we're in Mexico City, and like I was some American buddies, like other teenage kind of idiots. And we were like in the middle of like nowhere, like it's a seedy part of town, and the police pulled us over. And, you know, it's not guaranteed at that time period that when you encounter Mexican police, that they will be honorable upholders of the lay,
uh-huh.
The law.
Yes.
So we're kind of like, oh crap, what's going on? And then one of them asked, okay, which one of you guys speaks the most Spanish? And they're like, Idausa. I'm like, what, me? And then he's like, okay, listen to everything I'm going to tell you right now. And and then I just like, woo. And I was like, wow, I understand everything this man is telling me. Right. And then it came time for me to talk, and I had to perform. Made up whatever kind of excuses I had, like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, the words are kind of flowing out of me and rolling off my tongue. It was kind of like an out-of-body experience. I'm, like, looking at myself, speaking the language, like, what's going on? And then I somehow finagled us out of the predicament and, and got off scot-free.
Wow.
And yeah, that was kind of, if you're asking my superhero origin story, that's the moment that, I got bit by the radioactive spider when I decided to pay attention to the sound.
Yeah.
That would be the time that Uncle Ben died or something.
And then right. That's the first time you swung from a string and didn't yeah. land in your face. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah. That's basically it for getting into language. And then later on, in terms of becoming not just a learner of languages, but a teacher of them and understanding on a more systematic level what people were facing as challenges and how to solve those problems, that's kind of a different origin story. But I think you're asking about my just getting into language
yeah,
in general.
We'll definitely come back to the other piece sure. of that puzzle as well. So I think one thing that's interesting, you pictured yourself, speaking as if Antonio Banderas were saying that thing earlier on. And I recently came across a book that was talking about the power of alter egos.
Yeah, that book, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot the name of it off the top of my head, but we'll put it in the show notes.
It's called Alter Ego, yeah.
That's that would make sense. Effect, like that. Oh, that's right, that's right. Is that something that you encourage learners to do? Do you think that helps to kind of, instead of being, okay, I'm John now speaking Japanese, I'm this new person speaking this language. Do you think that can help people get over some of those psychological hurdles, or is it, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I've been focusing a lot recently in the things we're developing. So the Mimic Method is the name of my approach to learning language, but is also the name of my core philosophy to life and the way I see things, and again, too metaphysical, is that we are just constantly channeling spirits, so to speak. So you meet someone, you have a good friend, and you meet their parents for the first time, and then you're like, oh, that's why you laugh that way and talk mm-hmm. that way and act. It's like, oh, you see directly, the tree from which the apple fell, so to speak.
Right.
And what it is that that person mimicked his father or his mother or his brother. And when we learned English, that's precisely what happened. Every single word I'm saying to you right now, I didn't make it up, right? I literally copied it from mm-hmm. other English speakers growing up. So that is actually what language is. So in terms of getting over the psychological barriers and hurdles, I say Antonio Banderas and people say, oh, are you acting? It's like, yes. But what happens is you start to act these things out and maybe today it's Antonio Banderas, but then you're paying more attention. You're like, oh, maybe it's you see a movie and it's Gael Garcia Bernal or just some dude who you buy milk from in the street, whatever it may be. You kind of channel these people in your mind. And then the degree to which you're able to move your mouth and your face and your body more like that person, then the more you enter into that frame of, the culture of Mexico or speaking Spanish. And at first it feels unnatural. It feels, uncommon. But when you stay there and you keep practicing, you start to integrate that spirit and it expands you. So it's very tricky to understand for someone who hasn't gone through the process of feeling comfortable in a second language. Mm-hmm. But, when I speak, people ask me, am I a different personality when I speak Portuguese or Chinese or French or whatever? And it's like, yes and no, because it's still me. But as a result of learning those languages, I've expanded the definition of me. So I've incorporated it, and I'm not exactly Antonio Banderas, but there's a little piece of Antonio Banderas' soul
right.
living inside me, the same way that so much of my mom's soul and my dad's soul mm-hmm. and lives inside of me, So it's my approach to life in general, because, whenever I see people whom I admire for a quality that I don't currently possess, then it's really the same process. I just pay attention to how they move, how they act, how they interact with the world. And then I mimic it until it becomes part of me. And for me, mimicry and learning and growth, they're really all synonyms.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I dig that. One of the things that came to mind when you're talking about imitation and mimicry is, really, really talented people who can impersonate, other people like Frank Caliendo, for example. They do that voice, they're not just doing a voice. You see their facial expressions change, their body, their posture, everything. It is as if that spirit is inhabiting that person. There's a little spark of that. And I think that could help explain why it's more than just vibrations of the vocal cords. It's much, much more. So that's really
cool. And going off of that too, like you mentioned, there's a talent. And then as we all know, you know, even you've heard before, like that when we see people performing at a very high level, all we see is their performance at that high level. What we don't see is the 10,000 hours of failure that, you know, like went in behind it in the practice.
Yeah.
And exactly. And that gets back to my origin story in Mexico, which was that the talent that I now have that people would think of as a talent, is actually the result of paying lots of just painstaking, attention to how people are making sounds and movements and facial expressions. So you just get better and better over time, and you really can't fathom how good you can become at it until you yourself put in that same amount of energy and attention.
Absolutely. I think that's really important to point out, because I think if somebody's just starting out in a language, for example, and they see you speaking Spanish or some, one of the other, I think, six languages you speak fluently, you know, a lot of people, they're just going to immediately assume, oh, Idalza is just really good at languages. That's just, he just has that talent. He's always had it. Mm-hmm. He was born that way. That's not me. I'm not good at languages, which I always call BS, of course, because as you said, you didn't have that when you began. You got that through those 10,000 hours, through painstakingly laying down more and more myelin around every single neural circuit that lets you speak and move that like a native speaker. So let's go back then. Let's transition to how you got into teaching, how you developed the mimic method, and how that sort of has become its own beast.
Yeah, sure. So going off of what you just said about the talent thing, I do probably have some more of a penchant, you know, by dint of however my brain structured when I was born. So what happened is when I started to learn this way after Spanish, I wanted to learn Chinese. And I remember my brother already spoke Chinese, and he told me, like, hey, most important thing in Chinese is the tones. Yep. Make sure you get them right. So I spent like the first 3 weeks just like really listening to tones and like slow motion and mimicking and copying it and like, you know, obsessing over it. And at first it made no sense to me, but after a couple of weeks of paying attention, eventually it clicked and I was like, oh, got it. And then you go into Chinese class and you know, when you're in Mexico and someone's speaking with like a American kind of gringo accent, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, come on, man, like try it. Like, you know, you think you're just not trying. But in China, everyone who's there learning Chinese knows very well that if they don't say it right, they will not be understood. Yeah. Because
yeah, it's not intonation. It's actually different meanings for those that are uninitiated.
Different
yeah.
meanings.
Right.
Exactly. So, you know, the difference between saying like, you know, ma and like ma is right. This is like horse and like mother. Right. So yeah. like, you know, like, it's a difference between you getting slapped in the face,
yeah.
you know, at a dinner party.
Right,
so
right.
Everyone knows that, yet nevertheless, I would find people were struggling really hard. I'm like, no, it's not this, it's ma. And then they do like ma, and I'm like, no, ma. And then they're like, ooh, I don't hear the difference. So I started to kind of, I'm like, huh, it's not just a question of will. People are actually finding it hard from an ability point of view to mimic, to do these things. Why is that? So I was thinking about that a lot, investigating. I started learning more about how the brain works, about phonetics and all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, I went to Brazil after I graduated university. I became kind of infatuated with the culture. And I was like, okay, I just got to go to Brazil before I die. So I might as well go now. And I'm just going to focus on three things: Brazilian jiu-jitsu, Brazilian Portuguese, and Brazilian music, because I love the music.
That's a good
I discovered
trifecta of Brazilian
yeah,
culture.
It was a perfect trifecta. And it was a perfect kind of like a, you know, cauldron to brew what became the mimic method. Because what happened was I was there learning how to play these musical instruments. I was trying to be part of this kind of samba percussion band. And I found myself struggling really hard to learn these Brazilian rhythms, because they were so different from what I was used to in the American thing. I grew up playing violin, and I'm like, what's going on here? Like, I don't like sucking that stuff. And then one day I sat down, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to deconstruct this whole thing and then figure out what it is. So sat down, I took all of their repertoire for this group I wanted to be part of, and broke down all their songs, figured out a way to teach it to myself, and then just did the kind of method I came up with. And then very quickly I learned it. I was like, ha, got it. And then it just kind of, once again, that click happened. And then I went in, was able to join with the band, perform with them, you know, and on like their New Year's celebration, all these people were there. It was like a really like one of those kind of most meaningful moments of my life type deal. And then later on, a couple of weeks later, I'm just kind of like on a bus, just kind of like hanging out. Like, and then one day, like, poof, like my mind explodes. I'm like, oh, and then like every single violin lesson from my childhood, every single like language interaction I've had all kind of came to mind at once. And I realized, I said, ah, so the number one reason why people are struggling to learn foreign languages is because their ears are blocked and their mouth is blocked. They can't hear the tones. They can't hear the sounds, and they can't create them or articulate them with their mouth.
Right.
But this problem of coordinating fine motor articulation with nuanced differences in sound, we've already solved this problem in the musical realm. We already know how to teach people this stuff. The problem is no one's, you know, if we don't have to teach someone how to move their fingers and play violin, but no one's teaching anyone how to move their tongue and their lips and their mouth to play the music of Brazilian Portuguese or Mandarin right. Chinese, right. French or Italian. And I was like, so I was like, wait a minute. So I like got off the bus and like ran home. Cause I had like that system I had used to teach myself those Brazilian drums. I just adapted that to sing a Brazilian song or an English series of words, but as a series of musical notes of certain articulations. Right. And then I kind of feverishly like wrote out a bunch of things. I was like, oh, and then I went out into the street. And then I started grabbing like random Brazilians and random foreigners, and I would teach them live how to sing and rap different songs with a perfect accent without them even knowing what they're saying. So there's people, Brazilians who've never spoken a word of English ever, and now they're singing these songs with really good accent. Mm. And it's just because they weren't focusing on the meaning. They were just focusing on my cues for how to position and configure their right. mouth. And then that later, I'm like, ah, this is it. And then that later, I figured out a way to kind of digitize and kind of systematize that process. And in a year or two later, I came up with like the first online course around this called The Flow of Spanish, where you just learned how to sing and rap songs in Spanish as a means to like wrap your mouth around the language and capture the flow of the language. And the people liked it a lot. And then we've expanded from there. So that's basically the origin of it, where it was just really about teaching you how to use your mouth and how to use your ears, which is the foundation of linguistic communication. So people focus too top level on like literacy theory of grammar, and then they get lost in all the complexities of that. But yeah, the fundamentals are, they need to be, the exact is backwards. You need to start with the fundamentals. So that's really how we came up with the mimic method there.
Which is exactly how, you know, all of us learned our first language. We didn't start crawling on our tummies and reading. You know, we listened for a few years and then babbled and then spoke and then eventually learned to read and write. You know, one thing I always wonder, though, because we're all adult learners, that at least in this audience here, do you think, is there harm in learning reading and writing simultaneously as you learn to listen and speak, or do you think you should just listen and speak first and then only add in reading down the road?
Yes. So I prefer to use friction rather than harm. It's counterproductive friction in learning literacy prematurely. Here's why. You mentioned the baby babbling. I learned the other day that a baby babbles every single possible human phoneme, like every baby does.
Yeah. It's cool.
And then what happens is you're in an environment and your brain starts to specialize and it starts to prune away all the sounds and movements that are not useful. So I don't need to roll my tongue to you know, in Kansas, right?
Yeah, I don't need any retroflexes here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what happens then is you start to kind of, you know, niche down to what's relevant. And then you learn a literacy. So then you know, most people nowadays, you know, if you're an educated place, you learn how to read and write by like first grade when you're like 6 or 7 years old. And then from then on out, you're inundated in a world of scripts. So if you think every single time you see the letter T, like how many times might have you seen that letter in your life? Like who knows, like billions. You're subconsciously making and reinforcing an association between that visual symbol and a movement with your mouth and a sound effect. So you're like, every time you see a T, right? But then you go to Brazil and then all of a sudden the whole paradigm shifts. And from now on, that exact same symbol is now a different sound effect and a different movement. It's a ch, right? Chiago, Kenchi, right? Which you would then, as an English speaker or an English writer, associate to a different set of symbols, a C and an H. But, you know, when a C is different, it could be a S, but sometimes it's a K, right? And what happens is if you actually break all this down, which I show people sometimes in like different visualizations, you cross the wires a lot. Yeah. So as someone who's, I've listened to like thousands of hours of people trying to pronounce things in different languages and helping them with the pronunciation. And you know, I've traveled a lot. I've come to realize that I'd say about 50 to 60% of the pronunciation errors people make are not the result of them lacking that sound in their phonetic inventory, but rather they are saying the word as they see it written in their head, which right. means had they never been exposed to that written symbol,
right.
they
right.
wouldn't have gotten that decoy. And yeah. it's really hard to untrain habits. So
yes.
reading,
well,
writing,
you can't, you can only, that's one of the things I've learned recently is you can never actually, you can only make a stronger signal that overrides the previous habit, which, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what the friction and the harm is. It's essentially
yeah,
like,
good point. Yeah.
The high chance you'll develop bad habits that need to be unlearned or rather replaced, like you said later, which yeah. is more work.
It is, yeah, and it's there's already enough work to do, so why give ourselves
trust me,
more?
You only stack more, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the example I always love to share with people, especially if they're learning English, is even as a native speaker of English, until I was 14 or 15 years old, I would always say hyperbole. Instead of hyperbole, because I'd only seen it written. I'd never heard it.
Yeah, I've right? had a couple of those.
Sure. I mean, that's not true. I had heard hyperbole, but I thought that was something else. And so I had these two different things living in my head. And I think it was in a class. I said it out loud, or I was reading aloud or something, and the teacher laughed and then pointed out my error, which, of course, embarrassment.
Traumatized you.
Yeah, well, trauma, you know, there's a fine line between hormesis and trauma. And it was it helped me remember it. I never forgot that again. Yeah, definitely. I think that's really powerful to help people understand that that anyone can learn how to pronounce correctly, but they have to do it in the right way. First, mm-hmm. you have to train your ears, and then if you can't hear it, you can't pronounce it. So mm-hmm. focusing on that ear training. Do you think beyond just getting the sounds into their ears and their mouth, do you think the music also helps them in terms of memory and you know helping them remember like entire phrases at a time? Is that something that you talk about?
Absolutely. There's lots of benefits. So we try to incorporate as much music as we can in our materials. And for several reasons, one is, like you said, when you engage memory, sorry, when you engage music, music is, you know, tied to your memory. Basically in general, the more modules you have in an experience, the more engaging it is and therefore the more memorable. So listening to someone speak, you know, normally versus speaking with like background music, you know, it's a different environment. And the second one is more engaging. But also, when you're listening to songs and whatnot, you know, let's just say a rap song, which I like to use a lot. What actually makes the rap art form or good rap is it's playing with the natural rhythm and rhyme of the language. So the rapper will be repeating vowel sounds, you know, at the end of each phrase. And we put you in a daze and then here in a haze. And what that does is if you're someone and you're trying to learn the vowel A, then having that repetition of it starts to bring your brain's attention to it more and deepen that kind of connection in your mind. And then also just, you know, learning is the degree to which you learn something is a factor of how engaged you are in the moment of learning. Mm-hmm. And of course, music is one of the most fundamental primordial forces for human engagement. You know,
absolutely.
Like just think about when you walk into a room that's playing really good music and all of a sudden your body's moving, like what's going on,
right.
you know? So, yeah, there's lots of things
move.
That go into it.
Yeah,
exactly. And I, you know, in an original course I made, the Flow of Spanish, the main reason is just more practical in the sense that in order for you to learn a brand new sound, brand new pronunciation and way of using your mouth, you need to do lots of repetitions.
Yeah.
And if I'm trying to learn how to say the word like ferrocarril, And I'm just like, I have to do a lot of reps to get it right. Like, I was not able to say that word, you know, 10,000 reps ago. And I just sat there in my room in the darkness going, ferrocarril, ferrocarril, right? That's one thing versus playing something like salsa music, ferrocarril, ferrocarril, ferrocarril. You know, like, oh, all of a sudden it's like fun.
Yeah.
I'm in the shower getting my reps in, you know, just for fun. So that was more of a pragmatic kind of use of it.
Yeah. I think it was Katsumoto who said, fun gets done. Like, that's one of the best.
Oh, I love that. That's phrases. Great. Fun gets done.
Fun gets done. Yep. Yeah. I think there's so much out there that people, they just force themselves through these awful, boring materials and courses. And of course they quit. I mean, you know, willpower only lasts so long. You can't, can't keep doing it. But if it's fun, then you don't have to force yourself anymore.
Exactly. Flows forever.
There you go. What are some common, we talked a little bit about this, but what are some of the common bad bits of advice that you hear a lot in the language learning world or myths that you see?
I mean, the major myth for sure is we touched upon is the idea that you should be literate and go with reading and writing first. Now, I understand, like, one of the missions of our company is to provide the materials and the environment so that if you do subscribe to this learn by ear, you know, hear and converse before you get into literacy, if you subscribe to that approach, it's actually very difficult to learn that way because no one has materials for that, you know, except for us really and like a few other people. So it's definitely more challenging from just a pragmatic point of view. And that's why people do it. But most people give the advice or have the unquestioned assumption that there's no way to learn a language without seeing it written down first. I'm like, that's obviously absurd.
Right.
If you just look at the history of written language, like the vast
majority
of humans.
It's pretty young.
Yeah, it's really young. The vast majority of humans were illiterate up until like, you know, like 70 years ago.
And many still are. And, look at any hunter-gatherer.
And many still are.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just like, so I wish I put that into perspective for people. Human language in terms of oral communication has been around as long perhaps as consciousness.
Right.
So like, it's a much deeper thing. So to say
as music, they think.
I mean, exactly.
Right.
And music, there's a whole deep thing about there. Like, you know,
they actually
emerge from the, potentially from the same origin.
Yeah. Which came first, the chicken or the song. Yeah.
Exactly. And the other one that goes along with that is theory and grammar. People ask like, well, how can I learn how to say stuff if I don't know the grammar? I'm like, do you know the grammar of what you just said right in there?
Right.
You probably don't.
Right.
Like, you don't need to learn how to, you know, conjugate. You don't need to know a conjugation chart in order to conjugate.
Correct.
You know, I always say, I give a grammar example to people. I say like, if I say to you, I has a cheeseburger, you will instantly know that it was ungrammatical if you're a native English speaker. The question is why? Is it because you consulted your eighth grade English class and like went to page 24 in the textbook and you're like, oh, the verb has to agree with the subject and number. Like, no, you're just like, that sounded wrong. Exactly.
Right.
Keyword, sound. Get the sound right.
Yep. Yeah, I always tell people that you don't actually need a language teacher. You just need a native speaker because any native speaker who's 5 years old or older will tell you something's right or wrong. They won't know why, and that's okay. You don't need to know why. I mean, my background is in linguistics. I think the why is fascinating, but it's not necessary.
Sure,
it's an extra layer of complexity that if you're into it, go for it. But don't let that be a barrier to getting started.
Definitely. Yeah, and it does have utility. It does have utility to kind of know those things, but only at an advanced stage.
Absolutely. It comes in later.
If you don't know how to play piano at all, and I start sitting down teaching you like music theory and the circle of fifths and all this kind of stuff, you'd be like, what? Because there's no foundation for you to reference.
Is there anything that you've changed your mind about in the last couple of years or since you got started in language learning?
One of the major, probably most important insights I've had about life in the past, I think I guess it would be like 5 or 6 years now, is the nature of personality difference. I got really deep into psychometrics and personality psychology and all that kind of stuff. And I used to think that, you know, once again, the reason why someone wasn't doing this or wasn't putting themselves out there or wasn't making this attempt to do this was just because they were like, you know, being lazy or like they weren't overcoming their kind of fear. As I got to understand just more and more how other people perceive the world so vastly differently based on their, you know, not just their background, but just even this is the raw structure of their personality. So one example is the difference in the extroversion scale and the degree to which people feel resistance is the word I use to putting themselves out there in a new social situation. People really underestimate the degree to which just social dynamics plays in language learning. Because if you think about it, there needs to be a degree of social depth and variety in your interactions. But then that means you have to go out and meet a whole new group of people, right? So I'm a pretty extroverted person. So the degree to which that is, you know, scary to me, it can be vastly different from another person. So in terms of just kind of adjusting teaching models and trying to accommodate people's different emotional needs in the learning process, I used to not think was that important. Like you just gotta make a one size fits all and then put it out there. Now I'm realizing that like, oh, actually it's a, really important to make things as much as possible tailored to the specific needs of each student. Yeah, one of my things I'm working on now actually is because I have my own kind of personality models. And for me, you know, there's a lot to understanding someone in general, but say the learning how to communicate with someone in like, you know, French, right? I've come to realize that learning how to communicate with someone in your home language, but of a different personality type, so much is lost in communication, specifically between certain types of people. And so right now I've been thinking a lot and trying to create content for people to get better at having kind of a cognitive empathy for different types of people. And it's like, oh, this is why this person is not behaving in the world the way I would, because he's a different person, right? You know, and like, yeah, it's important. Yeah. That's why you should learn language, you know, it's like it actually shapes, expands the way you see the world. And I think that's really important, if not the most important thing for people to do in their lives.
No, it's huge. No, I think that's a really important and underappreciated component. And I talk a lot about psychology in my own writings. And I think personality type is definitely, it's a huge untapped thing. So it's cool to hear you're digging into that stuff more. Mm-hmm. So in an ideal world, if you had all the time, you weren't running the Mimic Method business, if you just had the whole day to yourself, what would an ideal day of language learning look like for you today?
Wake up early and prioritize the solo work component. Mm-hmm. So depending on what stage I'm in, but we'll say in the very beginning stage, I'm really going in on the sounds, learning what the sounds are. Then I'm kind of picking up different words, trying to make sure I can pronounce different words properly. Then I'm looking at songs, breaking them down, breaking up phrases. And I'm trying to get to my first stage of learning a language is getting to the point where I can mimic. Meaning someone could say anything to me, like any 8-syllable phrase is my benchmark. And I should be able to repeat that back exactly how that person said it, right? And then once I have that, then that morning time will be dedicated to something like Pimsleur or something that's available that's audio-based, mm-hmm. where they're presenting the basic concepts to me, like this is the sounds we use to refer to this, right. This experience, this word. So kind of mornings, deep work, solo stuff is for that. And then, you know, as I become more social throughout the day, I would then dedicate afternoons to this would be more of a practice type deal. So if the morning's about perception and make associations, then the afternoon would be like, okay, speaking with an individual, say tutor or someone, and like having conversations, asking them questions, just trying to get that communication and that one-to-one intimate thing. And then my late afternoons and evenings would be performance, meaning you don't really learn something until you actually have to use it. You know, it's not until the cop stops you in the street and you have to speak Spanish that you really know Spanish.
So you go and drive around trying to get pulled over.
I just go looking for cops in the game. You know? And like, but like I would go to some kind of social, I would spend a day looking for some way to use it in a social context. If I'm not in the country, then I'd have to schedule it out with like, you know, calls with people. But you know, I prefer to be in the country if possible, sure. Or if I'm, or like, you know, or I just like being in person. So if it's like a meetup somewhere or whatever. But the idea is that like, now that I've practiced the things in the morning and the afternoon, I want to go out there and actually use it in a real life scenario. And then I would just repeat that. And then at the end of the day for the kind of debrief, I'd kind of reflect on it and be like, oh, what were situations where I wish I had performed better, right? Like, I didn't know how to communicate in this scenario. Let me, you know, bring that question to my tutor the next day or do a bit of research the next morning. So yeah, and one other major element of that, once I've gotten past the Pimsleur stage in the morning, I would then move it to scripting. So I kind of know, okay, I'm going to this event today. Let me like prepare what I'm going to say and then rehearse it with my tutor and then perform it in the evening. So that would be the rapid way, the fastest way for me to get from zero to, you know, conversational fluency.
I love it. Do you have a preferred place you find tutors, like Italki, or are there other services you use, or?
No, I mean, I actually, it depends on the language. Like, you know, the recent ones I've done, it'll honestly, a lot of it would be like a romance inspired thing. So like I start dating someone, I'm like, oh, I'll learn Italian. And then that person would then become the person I speak to right. on that level. But if I don't already have a good, you know, an intimate friend or relationship to do that, then yeah, the way I would do it, I'd go on any of those websites and then you just have to commit to like burn through a bunch of people until someone you click with and like, yeah, just do that.
Yeah. I think that's an important thing to pause here and point out. Cause I think a lot of people, they'll try out one of those services. So they'll not really click with or enjoy the first tutor they get. And then they'll just say, oh, tutoring is not for me, and throw in the towel. But
for sure.
Yeah, definitely set that expectation that commit to do at least like 5 tutors and don't feel that you have to talk to them again if you don't connect.
Exactly. And I went with a friend today to the hospital. She was feeling sick and then the doctor didn't have good like bedside manner and but she's fine. And then I was talking to her and I was like, you know, one thing I learned from hiring people and stuff like that is the base rate, you know, assumption is that most people, unfortunately, are not really competent in what they do.
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of display the numbers game until you click. Yeah. So,
or they're competent, but they're not pleasant.
Yeah, not pleasant. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's kindness, competence, and usually it's one or the other. But some people, you know, there's enough of them to make the world go around.
Right.
Some people are both, and you just have to kind of go through a bunch until you figure out the cues so you can find them even quicker. But yeah, like you said, just commit to, you know, at least 5 and don't assume that like your first experience is definitive of all the other tutor experiences any more than this doctor is representative of every single doctor ever. You know,
it's just like dating, going back to dating, you know, you're not going to marry the first person.
Any human interaction, any interaction,
absolutely.
Only a minority of them actually work really well.
Yep. You said that's kind of a typical day. Let's ratchet it back. So you have a super, super busy day. You're traveling or you're sick or you know, life conspires sort of to get in the way of your ideal schedule. What is like a minimum viable language learning day look like? What are the few absolute things that you do no matter what?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for me, it's all about the key variable there is resistance. Meaning, you know, or put another way, how much willpower will I need to muster to do this thing? And if it's a very busy day, then I have very limited time and willpower to do it. So the lowest willpower while still highest productive activity I would do, once again, depending on the stage. I like audio stuff. So like I said, if I'm at a Pimsleur stage and it's just listening for 30 minutes while some, you know, there are people are talking and making connections, that's pretty low resistance for me. Even lower than that, if I don't have time or energy to do that, would just be purely just like listening to music or radio or whatever audio thing or video thing you like to watch stuff, and then just mimicking. So I'm always encouraging people to always be mimicking, meaning like even now I'm in Portugal, I speak Portuguese fluently. If I walk down the street and I just hear someone be like, "Get this one much for me," you know, it's like some little weird like sound effect, I'll just mimic it and have fun with it. And that, even if I don't know what the guy said or whatever, just the process of just listening and trying your best to repeat the sounds or just repeating one aspect, like the intonation or the rhythm, that's kind of fun. And like, you know, especially with music, like that would be my bare minimum, just to keep it activated in my brain, you know?
Is there benefit to mimicking in your head? So if you're in a context where you can't speak out loud because it'll be socially inappropriate or awkward, do you think that there is a benefit, like, you know, tennis players, if they in their head imagine swinging the racket a certain way, it actually will help reinforce that neural pathway? Do you think
absolutely?
Yeah,
Absolutely. It's visualization training. And I mean, you scale it up. So just say it's a social situation and you embarrass yourself, then you can turn the volume down and you're muttering it. Mm-hmm. Or even if that's strange age, you can literally just move your mouth. And that is better than not moving your mouth. And then if you, for that reason, you don't want people to look at your mouth and then like, yes, visualization. I mean, I haven't seen like a specific scientific study that's shown this, but based on what I've experienced and know about things, then I would be very confident in betting that just imagining yourself, you know, making the sound is itself going to be beneficial.
Awesome. All right. Any last words for language learners who are just getting started and are needing a little pep talk to get going?
Yeah. One thing I've been thinking about recently is kind of like breaking the barrier and how before you cross a threshold, it can be extremely intimidating and like you have no idea what's going on. And just so much anxiety and wasted energy on the other side of the threshold before it. So, and the big one for language learning is actually speaking to someone.
Yes.
So the first thing I recommend to anyone who hasn't even started this thing is like, man, just go through the rounds of figuring out how to use italki, getting up and like having your first conversation or going to your first meetup, whatever the easiest barrier is to go and just speak to someone with whatever minimal amount of whatever you have, actually taking that step and watching yourself get through that nervous barrier, it just opens up your mind and your confidence and all kinds of stuff in ways you really can't fathom until you've done it. I know people will like study for years or like months on average without even interacting. And just remember, like, it's not about the language, it's about people. Language is the tool you use to connect with people. So if you're not actually interacting with people, then you're basically just swinging a hammer in the air. You know, like you're not doing anything with it, you know.
You might as well just study Latin.
Exactly. Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so important. And people think, oh, I'm gonna study till I feel ready. And then I'll start talking and then you're never gonna feel ready. Yeah, good luck with that. Never, never.
Get on the bike and fall.
That's right. It reminded me of do you know James Clear? You're familiar with his work? Yeah, he has that thing about, you know, when you're starting to work out and lift weights in the gym, your first habit is not lifting weights. Your habit is going to the gym. So
exactly.
Just go to the gym, you know, commit to being there for 1 minute and then you can leave and then do that for 3 weeks. And then you can start actually developing the next habit. So I like that of, you know, your first habit is not speaking the language. Your first habit is showing up at a meetup or getting on italki.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Yeah. No, I love it. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time. This was a fun conversation.
Yeah, it's great.
And I look forward to digging more into your stuff. And getting more people mimic.
That's right.
It's good stuff.
Cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, check me out, mimicmethod.com. We got new stuff coming out in the coming months and move free materials as well. And shoot us an email if you have any more questions. support@mimicmethod.com.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the Language Mastery Show. If you like what you heard, I'd highly appreciate a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And for show notes, again, go to languagemastery.com/show. See you next Friday.